This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Dr. Mark Kermode back at Wimbledon reprising his many successes here on Centre Court. Let's do the box office top 10.
Okie dokie.
Is that right?
Yes, that's usually how we do it, Simon.
Number
had total amnesia since you're out of the studio.
Number 10 is The Ruin.
Which I like. I mean, it's a mainstream horror movie in as much that it's DreamWorks back, but it is nasty. You know, a bunch of people go on holiday and they end up at a Mayan temple. Everyone says, oh, you shouldn't go there. They do, and they are attacked by ravenous plant life, necrotizing plant life, as I think you so adequately gave away the plot last week.
Yeah. Okay, so it's basically the plants.
Day of the Triffids meets Apocalypto. But it's actually quite good fun, and it is genuinely quite grisly, and it was nice to sit there watching a stupid popcorn movie thinking, you know, usually those things aren't nasty enough, but this is genuinely pretty nasty.
The Edge of Love is at 9.
Well, as you know, last week's resolution was I am no longer going to say I Keira Knightley, and I'm not Keira Knightley. Quits herself perfectly fine in this story, which
is Keira. So in future, in all correspondence, don't do the IKEA.
No, that's
joke.
It. That joke is now dead and buried, and
it
we're not doing it
anymore.
Buried,
to be honest, quite a few months ago.
No, I know, but I like to drag things around in a sort of zombie-ish way. No, she is absolutely fine, and it's a story which peripherally involves Dylan Thomas. I am completely unconvinced by Sienna Miller, who, as I said last week, I really don't know what her accent was meant to be. I think her character was meant to be Irish, but it's a love quadrangle story, and it's fairly inert, but Keira Knightley is perfectly fine. And as I said, this is the beginning of a new leaf. From now on, no more Keira bashing, unless, of course, she makes another terrible
movie.
Is it
love in a quadrangle or a four-way love split?
It is a four-way love quadrangle. It's a love quadrilogy.
So there's four of them in the quadrangle?
There are, yeah. That's why it's a quadrangle, because if there was three of them, it would be a trilogy. And if there was two of them, it would be a tryste. No, what do you call that?
A duo?
A duo.
Or something like that. Gone Baby Gone at 8.
You know, on the way out of the charts, but it has acquitted itself perfectly fine. I think it's a solid thriller from the same guy who wrote Mystic River. It demonstrates that Ben Affleck's career is probably behind the camera rather than in front of it. Casey Affleck, however, is very good. The problem with it is that it starts off being a fairly serious work and it then descends into abject silliness and melodrama. And it has the dopiest ending of a serious movie long time. But there is, two-thirds of it is perfectly decent.
Now, Teeth is at number 7, which I can... You were so elliptical in your description last year, plus I was drifting off. I didn't understand precisely what happened, but you've explained and it sounds horrendous.
Yeah, well, what I said to you was, it's a film about the Dentata myth, and you, of
course...
I don't
know what the Dentata myth is.
No, well, I'm not going to explain it to you. Everybody who's listening who understands what that is knows. And then there was a clip in it.
D-E-N-T-A-T-A.
Dentata, teeth... usually associated with another word, which I'm not going to say. We had a clip in which it was talking about celibacy, and we said, you know, it's a great gift, and like all great gifts, it should be kept wrapped. And yeah. I said, and of course the thing is, her gift has teeth, and you somehow failed, despite all this stuff, despite me brilliantly describing the movie without it. Anyway, I think it's very interesting. There's been a couple of emails in incidentally, which I'll pass to you later on, comparing it to Sex and the City, and saying that actually all the things that are wrong with Sex and the City are right with teeth. And it is directed by the son of Roy Lichtenstein, he of Wham, you know, not Wham the band.
Pop art.
Yeah.
It was in Wham.
Wake me up before you go.
That was him, along with Andrew Ridgely and George.
What's the connection between Andrew Ridgely and Eric Clapton?
Well, it can't be anything to do with music.
Neither of them ever played guitar on a Wham record.
Very good. We have a superhero movie at 6.
Just, you know, let all this end. Let Leslie Nielsen stop having to do this. We have got to the point now with movie parodies that all it is a series of lame jokes that somehow have some connection to a movie genre, and this really has to be the end of it. It's awful.
The Happenings at 5.
Much correspondence about The Happening again. I'll pass all these emails to you. You can do all that sort of stuff.
It'd be quite good if you did that like before we started the conversation.
Well, I came in like 3 minutes before and you suddenly said go. It's all to do with rain and things, isn't it? Right, fine. There's a bunch of emails. There has been some discussion about whether or not The Happening was cut before it came to the British Board of Film Classification, and apparently it was pre-cut. None of this explains why it is that the plot doesn't make any sense. There's a lovely email in there somewhere, if you can find it, explaining why it is that the wind blows in a suitably fatuous manner. I mean, it is a mess of a film, but on the other hand, at least it was trying to be something else. But all the email response have been saying that, no, it's just complete rubbish.
Ben in Birmingham,
yeah,
on this email which you just handed me, says, dear
Itchy and Scratchy.
No, it's
Ren and Stimpy.
Map and Lucia.
Oh, okay.
Some things in life defy explanation. The ability of a duck to know which direction south is, the tenacious determination of a headless chicken to continue running movements before death, and perhaps the most perplexing of all, the compelling self-destructive downward spiral that is M. Night Shyamalan's career.
Yeah. Are you going to say that as a joke? Is it now that I've stopped doing IKEA Nightly, are you going to say M. Night Shyamalan every time?
I've seen all the rest of his films, and I wanted to be sure that the God complex, the badly written dialogue and the apologetic acting were still there in The Happening. It must be a horrible thought to know that your greatest film is already 9 years behind you. How does M. Night get to sleep at night?
I think we should call him Shalimar. M. Night Shalimar.
Was he in Shalimar?
Well, let's imagine that he was, shall we?
Adulthood at four.
Which... I mean, it was interesting. Noel Clark was on the programme last week, and I said that my problem with Adulthood is this, that I think he's a more mature filmmaker than the film allows him to be. It's a sequel to Kidulthood, obviously. And for me, there was too much of, everyone waving around guns and swearing and a lot too, sort of too fast cutting, that kind of thing. What I think's interesting was he said, well, it's a kind of valid criticism, and I do have a bunch of other scripts that I really, really like to work on. I mean, I think he's a really talented guy, and I suspect that in 5 years' time, he will have made a much more quiet and much more grown-up work, because I really do think he's got talent. I don't think Adulthood is great by any means, but I think he is a very talented filmmaker.
Sex and the City at three. Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull at two.
I mean, again, interestingly enough, the audience have generally hated it more than I have. I didn't hate it at all. I just thought it was just incredibly unspecial. It was just another movie. It did look like it had just been made immediately after the first three, and nothing had moved on since then. I do agree with all the criticisms about the script. There's this hilarious thing that they threw out the Frank Darabont script ages and ages ago, and Spielberg said we wanted to wait until we got the script completely right. And as one listener said, well, then why didn't they use the script in which they got it all completely right? Why did they use the script that didn't make any sense at all? But it's, it is what it is.
The UK's number one is The Incredible Hulk.
And again, it's better than the Ang Lee film, but at least the Ang Lee film was trying to be something special. The Ang Lee film, which was just Hulk, although I think occasionally it was called The Hulk in different territories, was trying to do an art house movie about what happens with Bruce Banner and how his inner rage is unleashed. And of course, the stuff with Bruce Banner worked and the stuff with Hulk didn't. In the case of this, they said, okay, it's an action movie, but it still happened that as soon as he gets angry, he turns into the Jolly Green Giant, or he turns into Angry Shrek. And then the last half an hour of it is Angry Shrek versus other Angry Shrek hitting each other in parks. And it's just not enough. I think there's a fundamental problem here, which I think with now, since we have two such different films, demonstrates this. It doesn't work as a film. It works as a cheesy television program, and it just about works as a Marvel comic strip. But to be honest with you, I think there's a reason why the Marvel comic strip was so broken and disjointed. It's not a very good character. He gets angry, he turns into the Hulk.
Scott says, Dear Richard and Judy, I would like to take exception with Mark's review of The Happening, claiming that the film was sanctimonious and preachy. In this day and age, I feel it's very important, filmmakers, to highlight the dangers facing us due to man's constant attack on the natural world, and applaud M.R. Shalimar for tackling such a controversial issue. After seeing the film, I returned home and immediately threw away all my houseplants, ripped out the garden, and tarmacked over every inch of bare ground. We as a race should not be held hostage by these terroristic plants, and I only hope that M.R. Shalimar will reply to requests to give evidence in my forthcoming trial after an incident in Sherwood Forest involving a chainsaw, some petrol, and a limited amount of nudity. Yours truly.
Very good. But that is the review the film deserves, I'm afraid.
So there you go. We've whittled away, and we haven't done a single movie. But hey, the movies to be reviewed include
Prince Caspian, Narnia 2, as they don't like us to call it. Wanted, the action adventure movie in which James McAvoy demonstrates that he's been working out and now has a six pack. A Complete History of My Sexual Failures, and Female Agents, in which it is demonstrated newly to me that the French won the war by looking incredibly glamorous.
What do we go with first of all?
Complete History of My Sexual Failures, which is an enticingly titled and allegedly documentary story about Chris Waite, who's an independent filmmaker. We know this because he introduced himself at the beginning of the film. He says, I'm an independent filmmaker. And the theory is that this is a documentary that he's made about why it is that all the girls he has ever been out with have dumped him. And during the course of the documentary, he goes and interviews them to find out why it is that they've dumped him. Here is a typical clip.
I recently got dumped by my girlfriend, Alice, after only 3 weeks. She's one of a long line of girlfriends who dumped me. In fact, I've been dumped by pretty much every girl I've ever been out with. I've been dumped by email. I've been dumped by answer phone twice, actually. Two girls did that. I've been dumped by text message, dumped over a webcam. One girlfriend even wrote a novel which she dedicated to me, in which the boyfriend character bled to death after having a garden fork stuck in his throat. I guess that was her way of telling me that something was up.
Oh, it's got self-indulgence stamped over that.
And we start, this is him, he's lying in bed, he's talking to the camera, he's got the kind of the sub-Kurt Cobain, you know, hairstyle and the slacker. But, okay, here's a couple of important things. Firstly, the thing is sort of being sold as a documentary. In fact, at the Sundance Film Festival, it was nominated for a Grand Jury Prize in the World Cinema Documentary category. And I think my first problem is, it's clearly not a documentary. There is some of it that may well be true, but that person that he is doing, that voice there, is clearly a character that he's playing. I mean, I don't believe for one minute that the character in real life is actually, you know, is him. He's playing this kind of assumed character of, I'm a slacker, I can't get anything together, I can't get out of bed, I can't do this, I can't understand why nobody loves me. So firstly, it's a comic character. Secondly, several of the sequences in the documentary are so clearly and so clumsily reconstructed as to suggest that absolutely nothing we see is true. So, whereas it may well be true that some of the interviews with girlfriends are actually old girlfriends that he has tracked down and managed to interview, I never know which ones are real and which ones aren't. And my feeling about a documentary is once you cross the line, once you stop making, once you start saying, oh, I'm going to make some of this up, I just think, okay, fine, I don't believe any of it. So as far as I'm concerned, the whole thing is a fiction, even if some elements of it are true. That's a beginning problem. Second thing is, and I think this is rather more problematic, is that what happens during the course of this is that it's initially quite funny. I mean, he shambles around, he brings up girlfriends to find out why they don't like him, they tell him to get lost, he turns up attempting to interview him, they tell him to get lost, and there's a lot of him getting, and then he goes to see his mum, and his mum tells him he's a bit of a wastrel, but she saved some of his old love letters, which is a bit strange. And it's, so it's initially kind of quite, there's a nerdly little charm in it, but it very quickly runs out of steam. And when it runs out of steam, you can almost hear the producer saying, Chris, now we've really got to do something to pick this up. So firstly, he goes to see a doctor to investigate his problems in the physical side of the relationship department, which is incredibly indulgent, and I don't believe that either. Then he goes to see a dominatrix, which is clearly the moment at which the producer said, look, you really need to up the ante here. And this is the one scene, incidentally, which gets the movie an adult-only certificate. And it's so completely out of kilter with the rest of the thing. You know,
when he visits the dominatrix.
He visits the dominatrix, and the dominatrix smacks him in a way that a dominatrix would.
How's that, then?
Well, it's, you know, on afternoon radio when we're coming from Wimbledon, I suggest that in the same way as teeth, one should use one's imagination as to the way in which a dominatrix might smack you after you've said that you are failing in certain departments. Viewers are invited to fill in the blanks here. Worst of all, however, is towards the end of it, it's about two-thirds of the way, it's always two-thirds of the way through films that things really fall apart. He takes a bunch of Viagra. He takes a handful of Viagra. And then he apparently gets drunk. And he is then filmed running around on a street in London, in the West End, approaching women and saying, I desperately need to have sex. And I'm just sitting there watching this scene, and I'm simply thinking, one of two things is true here. Either this whole thing is a construct, right? You've made it up, in which case it just isn't funny. It's a really, really naff, misogynist, stupid construct. What's the matter? Did you completely miss the door? Do you not understand that there are certain forms of behaviour that are actually politically, socially, in all forms, unacceptable? Or it's not that, it's real, and he really was filmed doing it, in which case he really needs to be taken aside and spoken to with a rubber hose. And it's consequently, my whatever residual sympathy I have for his comedy potential, which at the beginning of the film, for the first 20 minutes of it, is all right, he's quite funny playing the slacker character, has evaporated by 30 minutes in, and by after an hour, I am really, really cross and annoyed and fed up with him, and really thinking this is just self-indulgent chauvinistic, flatulent nonsense, and it really has to stop. Now, it has had some likable reviews, and it has picked up, for a film that cost, you know, very little money, it has earned itself some form of theatrical life. It's just a shame that, you see, the idea of opening up, my girlfriend's dumped me, let me go and interview them and find out what's wrong with me. Where does that idea come from? Even you would know this. Where does that idea come from?
Somewhere else?
Nick Hornby, High Fidelity. You read High Fidelity?
I did read High Fidelity.
Yeah, well, you remember, well, the thing he does is he says, why do all my girlfriends dump me? I know, I'll go and interview them and find out. And he goes and meets each one of them, and each one of them he discovers you know, what it was that, in fact, he ends up thinking that the problems was all with them, which again is another thing which is completely repeating this. So it's derivative, it's dishonest, it's passingly funny at the beginning, and then it's really, really annoying. And I think it has a really deep misogyny problem that it doesn't even begin to address.
And everyone involved should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves.
Well, you know, the thing is that there is some jokes at the beginning that are quite funny. As a 20-minute short on Channel 4, with just him talking to the camera about what a total loser he is, even though I don't believe that that's him, I know it's a character that he's playing, it will be fine. As a feature film, it falls into the worst problems of the sort of mock documentary feature, that it can't decide what it's being, and whenever things run out of steam, honestly, this is always the case. If somebody goes to visit a dominatrix in a film, it's 90% of the time because we've just run out of ideas.
How often does that happen then?
Well, it happens whenever people have run out of ideas. I'll give you a very good example.
Well, I've seen lots of movies that haven't got any ideas. There's no dominatrix.
Can I give you a perfect example? There's a scene in The French Connection which was cut out of the final... This has just come to me. It was just cut out of the final cut of The French Connection in which the assassin goes to see a dominatrix. And it's cut from the final assembly of the film. And the reason it's cut from the final assembly of the film is it's completely worthless and pointless, but they did it because they were worried that nothing else was working.
Paul in Newcastle, was the Good Doctor's end to Kira bashing because he was frightened of being punched again? That was a splendid moment. That was when Benedict Cumberbatch was with us, and he punched you because he was so cross that you're so wrong.
He did, but it wasn't just that he punched me. He punched me in that way, which is very, very... I think you must only learn to do it at certain posh schools. With the knuckle between your two fingers extended, so that when you do that, it's like getting a dead arm or a dead leg.
He really meant it.
No, he did really mean it, yes. But, you know, in a non-comic way.
Len says, so the Good Doctor said that time is non-linear.
Yes, it is.
Nick Rhodes' films prove this.
Yes.
Rhodes' films are brilliant, but time is linear, unless you get this last week, and you never said it. Doctor Idiot.
That's very good.
It's not bad, is it?
Yes, that's very good.
The cover's coming off here at Wimbledon, which means that play might start at some stage, but then equally, it might start raining again, so we'll continue talking movies in just a moment. That was a very fine email. Oh, back on The Happening, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Your big thing...
My big thing about The Happening...
is...
I said, here's the thing. If you go and see The Happening, and no matter what you think of it, ask yourself this question. What's making
the wind blow? OK, Chris in Bristol. Well, in reply to your question, doesn't Mark realise the holistic interconnectedness of the ecological world?
Do you want to do another run at that?
Doesn't Mark realise the holistic interconnectedness... Doesn't Mark realise that we're all connected in the ecological world, unlike mankind's separateness? The natural world works as a whole. So it's this working as a whole in order to eliminate man's overbearing, overbreeding abuse of nature, which is making the wind blow. Come on, Mark, keep up.
Okay,
Chris.
Yeah. Exactly.
Does that explain it?
I think that, though, that the tone of that email, I think you read it in an incorrectly flat tone, was it should have been read in a far more sarky tone.
There weren't stage directions with that.
No, but it was clearly... shall I read it?
Paul Mullins, I don't know the guy who claims to have got dumped by all his girlfriends, with reference to your previous clip, but after listening to the clip...
I'm not surprised.
Exactly right. 85058, Wimbledon at bbc.co.uk.
Can I say in his defence...
Drewy says, greetings, Thelma and Louise. I take offence at Dr. Kermode calling the Incredible Hulk TV series cheesy. It was not, and how would he know anyway? He never had a TV till he became the BBC's renter sidekick.
Can I just say in Chris Hartsby, because one of the problems with slagging off Brief History of all my sexual failures is that you end up sounding really po-faced. He's meant to sound like a dork. He's meant to sound like... He's meant to be the person that you listen to and go, well, I'll tell you now why it is. But it's an act. Of course it's an act. But that's the one thing that he does get right is that he pitches that act as, I can't understand why nobody likes me. And everyone goes, well, I can tell you why nobody likes you. It's because you're a twit. But that's an act. He's not that person. I don't know what kind of person he really is in real life, but he's not that person.
Amongst the movie posters staring out at you from assorted buses and bus stops would be Prince Caspian. Narnia 2.
And what are they? Yes, so Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian, or Prince Caspian, Chronicles of Narnia? Which one are you going for?
Does it matter?
Well,
Prince Caspian,
Chronicles of Narnia. Okay, so the second Narnia movie, the second Narnia book to have been written, But I think the fifth in the actual chronological developmental thing.
Whatever you say, Doctor.
You know, so basically, here's the story. So the kids are back in wartime.
If
Britain,
the kids are united, we will never be divided,
as I think Jimmy Percy so eloquently once said. So the kids are back in wartime Britain. A tube train. They haven't been back to Narnia for a long time. They're really fed up with the fact they haven't. Because if you remember, in the last film ended with they have a golden age, a golden reign. Then they come back through the wardrobe, and then they're really, really young again. The uncle says you're never going to get back into there, and then the wardrobe closed. So they're on the station platform, train comes in, they get magically sucked into Narnia, whence they have been called. They arrive in Narnia to discover that the golden age over which they formerly presided has now gone. It is way back in the distant past, and Narnia has now been overrun by human Talmarines, one of whom, the handsome, the very handsome, the look at his hair, he's so handsome, he's actually the Prince Charming out of Shrek, only with different colour hair.
Nice.
There's a lot of fringe waving and there's a lot of shoulder there. Anyway, he has recently escaped from a plot to kill him by the evil king, and he is, in the end, going perversely to be one of the people that helps save Narnia. Here's a clip.
Ow!
Quiet, Luke.
Something pinched me!
Hey, stop pulling!
I'm touching you!
But all of you just... What is that?
Feels like magic!
Quick, everyone hold hands.
I'm not holding your hand!
What is it? Where do you suppose we are? Well, where do you think?
Well, where you think we are is that we're back in Narnia, but everything's changed, everything's different, everything's slightly sad, really. Now, the interesting thing about the first Narnia film was that it was widely dismissed, and I have to say that I fell into this as well, as being Lord of the Rings light. You know, it didn't have darkness at all. It was a very, very light, whimsical confection. And in fact, over the years, that light whimsy has kind of grown on me, partly because I've seen how much kids enjoy it on video, and partly because that is the nature of the story. It's not a very dark story. I mean, it is a Christian parable, clearly, with Aslan, everybody waiting for Aslan to come back, and then Aslan comes back, and then Aslan is sacrificed, and then he rises from the dead, blah, 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 fine, all that. And in fact, having now seen the original Chronicles of Narnia several times on
under family instruction.
Well, it's on in the house. It's impossible not to keep. So it's I have rather warmed to it. Now, in the case of the second one, they do a number of things. The first is they attempt to darken things up because the story becomes a slightly darker narrative. It is about the children aging to some extent, but it's about an age having passed. It's also rather more muddled. I mean, the film is 2 hours and 20 minutes long, and I have to say from the outset that if you're playing to a younger audience, 2 hours and 20 minutes is a big ask, and I think it's too long. I think there is at least 20 minutes that they could have lost. I think there's an awful lot of establishing stuff at the beginning that's frankly a little bit boring. There's also then, when we get into the darker passages, there are the big battle scenes that are shot in this dark, brooding, moody, you know, blues and browns and greys. And all it does is it reminds you how much this isn't Lord of the Rings. And in fact, the great charm of the original was that it was light and frothy, and that pizzazz, that sense of it being in the end of kids' fantasy was probably its great redeeming feature. Now, having said that, I don't think this is a bad film. I mean, I think it is a lot better and a lot more successful than the Golden Compass movie, which took the source material and really just let it fall apart in its hands. All the stuff that was going in those source novels just never made it into that Golden Compass movie. And as a result of which, I don't think anybody's entirely sure what the future of the Golden Compass projected trilogy, as they like to say in America, is.
Well, really? So Subtle Knife might not happen?
No, I think it's going to have to happen, but I don't know when it will happen and how it will happen. I mean, it's, you know, immediately afterwards, after the financial failure of Golden Compass, everyone was saying, well, are we going to go on? Where are we going to go from here? You know, what are we going to do? I mean, I think it will have to play out, but the question is how it will play out. Now, in the case of this, it's too long. There is a little bit of a problem that I think that not all the acting is particularly great. Some of it is a little bit wooden, although that Georgie Henley, the little girl who plays Lucy, is really charming and really funny, as she was before. Plus, you get Peter Dinklage, who's absolutely terrific, is one of my favourite actors. I think he's great, and he's, you know, gruff and grumpy in a way which only he can do. And then you get Eddie Izzard doing the voice of a swordsman mouse, although he is essentially doing the same voice that he did in Five Children and It when he was It. You know, he's that animated voice that he does. Then so he does all that. And the whole thing has this sense of, I want to like it more, I want it to be shorter. I want it to work for the kids who enjoy the first movie so much. It's not a masterpiece. It is baggy. The magic is not there in the way that perhaps it was in the first one, or at least the very, very young magic of the first one. Interestingly enough, BBFC gave it a PG rating. The BBFC say, they note that the violence in the film is a little stronger than The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, but it still falls within the PG classification, because in the end, although it doesn't have quite the shiny, happy surfaces of the original, it is still very much PG fair, and I'd say it's borderline PG-12 because there's a lot of fighting. And then the narrative has that terrible sense of deja vu. You're waiting for Aslan to come back, you're waiting for Aslan to come back, you're waiting for Aslan to come back, and then you know what?
Does he come back?
He comes back. So I wonder now how the rest of this is all going to pan out. There's one more. The next movie is it Voyage of the Dawn or Silverchair? I can't remember which is the next one. There's one more which has got the kids in it, which has got Prince Caspian in it. Whether or not they'll then go beyond that to do the rest of the books, I think is frankly anybody's guess. I noticed that both Dawn Treader, Voyage of the Dawn Treader and Silverchair are both allegedly in production or in pre-production according to the IMDb, but I think there's one more film in this and then that's it.
You might have noticed a smattering of applause from the crowd here on Centre Court. It's unlikely that it was for your review. Fine though it was. That'll probably be for announcement that play is due to start. We've had no play here at Wimbledon this afternoon, hence our wittertainment. Tom, on this, hi boys, after Mark's rant about only stupid people liking Sex and the City,
yeah,
I just thought I'd tell you that I have a doctorate from Oxford, I am a lecturer at Cambridge, and I loved it. Wittily written, and a whole lot better than most comedies. So actually...
What's the guessing that your doctorate is in microbiology?
Can't be specific. He's clearly...
No, I'm sorry.
So what do you have to have a doctorate in there? So some doctorates are better than others, are they?
Yes.
Like what,
for some example? Girls are bigger than others, some doctors are bigger, as Morrissey says, and some doctorates are better than others.
Anyway, listen, he might be the brightest person who liked Sex and the City.
Yeah, can I just...
Unless we know to the contrary.
But this is like, right, the huffy emails that we get from scientists saying, excuse me, stop bringing up the thing about, you know, how did fish get out of the water? There's a very good explanation of how, you know... Stick to your specialist subjects, kids. And now he's going to write in and actually say that he's a professor of literature.
Now, look, we need to talk about Wanted. A lot of the poster action coming for this 18-certificate movie. We've spoken to James McAvoy on the programme. Hopes are high.
Are they? Well, you've seen it, right?
I have seen it.
OK. Well, do you want to do the plot synopsis or shall I?
I think it's your job,
okay,
and you should do it.
Here's the plot synopsis, okay? This is from Timur Bekmambetov, who is the director of that huge Russian hit Night Watch and Day Watch, and I think there was going to be a third one, which was Dusk Watch or whatever, but that doesn't seem to have happened. Those movies were set in Russia, but frankly, you wouldn't have known it. They were Hollywood blockbusters, you know, for all their Russian setting, they were, even though they played out in Moscow. So, now, here is his USA movie. Story is, James McAvoy is a salaried schlub. Or so he believes, until, in an unexpected encounter in a supermarket, Angelina Jolie hoiks him aside, gets him into a speeding car from which he has a racy gun battle, and then introduces him to Morgan Freeman, who tells him that no, he is not a salaried schlub, but he is in fact a genetic descendant of a line of almost supernaturally powered assassins who go by the name of the Fraternity. Here's a clip.
Stay away from me. Just stay back from me. I have a gun, sir. All right?
My name is Sloan. This is Fox. And the others you see around you are all very good at killing. So if I were you, I'd keep the gun pointed at me. You don't want to point it at any of them. That's better.
You're insane.
No. Insanity is wasting your life as a nothing when you have the blood of a killer flowing in your veins. Insanity is being beat down, coasting through life in a miserable existence when you have a caged lion locked inside and the key to release it. This gun you're holding is an Emanishi 17. It belonged to your father. He could conduct a symphony orchestra with it. And you're going to use it to kill the man who shot him down in cold blood. The same man who tried to kill you tonight. Your father was one of us, a fraternity of assassins. The weapons of fate.
Wow.
It doesn't matter what he's saying, but you're in Shawshank, aren't you?
Absolutely.
You're just there.
Shawshank Redemption all over again.
I hope to see my friend Andy again. I hope the ocean is as blue as it might. It's impossible to listen to Morgan Freeman without that.
This is not the Shawshank Redemption.
No, it's completely the opposite of the Shawshank Redemption. Now, I would like to throw this open to the listeners, because what happens is, he explains that their fraternity, who are so clever that they can bend bullets with their mind, with the power of their mind, the bullets can be bent.
I believe that. Yeah, I believe they can do that.
And the thing that commands their actions for bending bullets is... The Loom of Fate.
That was my favourite bit.
The Loom of Fate.
It has, when James McAvoy was on the programme, I said to him, it was a bit like the late, great Humphrey Littleton. At the end of I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue, he would always say something like, and now the Loom of Fate approaches the Weave of Death, or something. You think, and as soon as he says, this is the Loom of Fate, you go, no, sorry, knitting. It doesn't.
But there's a thing at the beginning of the movie when it says, you know, in ancient times, there was a society of assassins, the Weavers. You know, Weavers? There was a laugh then. But when Morgan Freeman explains the Loom of Fate, which is a loom, which literally makes material, the flaws in which tell them in binary code who they should be assassinating. Now, this has obviously launched a puntastic frenzy amongst critics, and I would now entreat the listeners to write in. I mean, I got as far as, you know, disappointment looms. Gradually, the director loses the thread, the action wears thin, the material is risible, I was knitting my brow. All those are
very
fine.
Good.
I now please invite you to fill in your own loom-connected pun slagging off the plot of, because even if you haven't seen the film, you really are morally required to laugh at the Loom of Fate.
This says, Dear Simon and Mark, rather conventionally, on Wanted. The film did not open with Wanted by the Doolies, as I'd hoped, but more of the usual pompous action movie
Wanted
fare by Danny Elfman. Probably.
The other one.
With a cast list including Morgan Freeman, James McAvoy and Terrence Stamp and that bloke from Hustle, Mark Warren, I was expecting an above-average comic hero tale, but it was just an entertaining but average comic hero tale. I was offended, this continues, more by the gratuitous swearing. Is that necessary, dear, as Dame Edna Everidge used to ask, than by the gratuitous violence? I mean, it has to say, it is all, I think this is unique, because it's a sort of an action hero silly adventure thing,
silly,
and it's an
8,
but it's an 18 certificate because of the violence.
Well, yeah, because, it is insanely violent. I mean, it is complete rubbish. The thing with Timur Bekmambetov is he basically is the Russian answer to Michael Bay. I mean, he is, you know, Mikhail Bevatov, frankly, because that's what he does is, he does a whole bunch of things running along and exploding and car crashes. And I mean, this is the kind of movie in which there are car chases. There are two people in the cars that you're meant to care about. And it doesn't matter what happens to any other car on the road. It's like, apparently, in the course of one car chase, there are hundreds of cars and buses and stuff go off the road. At one point, a train comes off the rail, but it doesn't matter because that's not the characters that we're interested in that train. So huge, gargantuan death tolls don't make any difference at all.
Steven Seagal principle.
Exactly. It is even Steven Seagal didn't kill that casually. The other thing about it is...
Oh, he did.
No, he didn't.
Do you remember the rocket he sent into China from that train? Oh, well, a lot of Chinese dead.
Which one's that? No. Did he rocket a whole bit of China?
He did. That was the movie that I then cancelled Steven Seagal's appearance.
Under Siege 2. Oh, no, you're quite right. I stand corrected.
Anyway, dear Bubble and Squeak, Simon says, there is a God. My proof is that at the Odeon in Richmond last Friday evening, they had a fire alarm and we all had to leave the cinema. This was 3/4 of the way through The Edge of Love, and I was just contemplating whether I could kill myself by sticking my head in an empty popcorn bag. The doctor's review is quite wrong. The acting is fine. It's just a mind-numbingly boring film about a group of totally disreputable people. If this film is a quarter true, Dylan Thomas was a truly ghastly person and not worthy of being captured.
But that is one of the great things in its favour, is that it is a movie about Dylan Thomas, which says that he may have been an interesting poet, but on a personal level, he was a complete wastrel.
So we were talking about Wanted. See the podcast for the first bit of this. Now, clearly,
yes,
it's nonsensical.
It's rubbish.
Clearly, anything that's got the Loom of Fate in there is not to be taken seriously. However, it's enormous fun. It's a big bunch of
stupid... Did you think it was enormous fun?
Yeah, I thought it was.
Okay.
Although it does have some really, really important plot problems.
Yeah.
For example, and without giving anything away, if...
There's nothing to give away, but go ahead.
If an estranged member of your family is trying to get in touch with you, there are easier ways than shooting bullets at them.
There is a plot twist which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's a film in which Angelina Jolie runs around being incredibly pulchritudinous and pneumatic, and yet all the sex in the movie...
Pulchritudinous and pneumatic.
And pneumatic.
All at once.
And yet all the sex in the movie basically consists of people fondling guns. I mean, it's the biggest gun fetishist movie in a very, very long time. It's like that stupid stuff about holding the gun in a certain way and clicking the thing. I mean, it is a movie made by people that go, "Gaw, look at that! It's a Glock 9mm dingy bongy blittly." And it's that I kind of find slightly annoying. And it is also rather sad that the nastiest person in the movie happens to be this overweight woman who gives James McAvoy a hard time in the office, which kind of fits in with this sort of rather unpleasant body fascism that the film's going on, which Angelina Jolie, she good because she Angelina Jolie. That person in the office, she bad largely because she's not. She's overweight, which bothered me slightly. And there is a James McAvoy issue as well, which is that James McAvoy is clearly pumped up to play the character in the thing after he turns into the super assassin. But did you notice that there is only one shot, and it's a long shot, in which you see him walking along with the top off and the greased top, which is meant and say, look how enormously huge my six-pack now is. Because evidently, I mean, no matter how much he's pumped up, he is still James McAvoy. But he is still Mr. Tumnus.
Harold and Maud, I've not seen Unwanted yet, but it's already giving me the needle already.
Yeah, boom.
James King on the other side apparently has just said Wanted an ace 4 out of 5. Is it Brill or what? Because that's the way young people speak.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, while we have a moment in these early moments of the second set, tell us about this other... you were teasing us with a French secret agent movie. Well,
there's this thing, Female Agents, which is... there's posters for it up all over the place. It's a French film about how it was that, in fact, the reason that the war was won pretty much by five glamour... We're coming up to D-Day, OK? The story is, there's a geologist. He's been arrested. He's pretending to be a German prisoner, but in fact, he's a top geologist with knowledge of the D-Day landings. They have to go and get him back, otherwise D-Day will not happen. So what happens is that Winston Churchill says, I want you to get me five of your top French agents, but very importantly, make sure they're all very glamorous. Make sure one of them worked at the Folies Bergères. Make sure that one of them conveniently went out with an SS officer. Make sure they're all, you know, they're just this side of floozy, but on the other hand, they are basically, and they will go in and they'll do the Band of Sisters thing, and they'll say, and it's a really peculiar movie, because it's one of those throwback films in which everybody smokes a lot, and everybody walks around the stations with lots of steam blowing out, you know, behind them in a very sort of backlit fashion. And it is apparently, it's insane. Inspired by the true story.
What does that mean?
Well, exactly, of Lisa de Bassac, who really was, you know, a genuine undercover agent and worked with many genuine undercover agents and did a lot of enormously heroic things. But the fact of the matter is, I don't believe that the heroic things that she actually did are anything like the heroic things which are represented on screen here, which are rather like Paul Verhoeven's film Black Book. I like Black Book, Zwartbuch, because at least Black Book was kind of upfront about how sort of sleazy it was. And Paul Verhoeven never has any embarrassment about that sort of thing. But this kind of has that morally righteous feeling about it, but yet it's old-fashioned and yet it's clunky and the dialogue's all over the place. And there are some absolutely laugh-out-loud, risible moments in it. And then there are other moments of sort of torture and horror and unpleasantness which don't sit quite as... I mean, it's not terrible, but it is basically a TV movie with lots of backlighting and everybody looking absolutely fabulous as they single-handedly win the war.
Which always goes down very well.
It does, because I think it's very important that they only recruited the best-looking people to infiltrate, because otherwise, obviously, it wouldn't... You know, if they got that woman out of Wanted, for example, it wouldn't have worked. And that, I think, is a bit of a problem for me. I don't honestly believe that Winston Churchill did do that. He didn't have a portfolio of people and went, oh, yeah, she's really nice, let's have her.
And that movie, again, is...
Female Agents.
It's not a great title.
It isn't. No, it's not.
I mean, there must be 100 better titles than that.
Female Agents, yes. It's about a bunch of female agents. And I think, actually, the worst thing is, if it is inspired by... I mean, it is inspired by a true story rather than based on a true story, that clearly the people whose legacy it is honouring, I think it is doing something of a disservice to. That said... It's like that thing that Monty Norman once said about, when he, completely disparagingly, he said, goes down well with a cup of tea at 3 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. And that's pretty much it with female agents. There really is no need to trouble yourself by going to the cinema to see it.
This from Ian in Romsey, knee-deep in cleaning materials. Mark, from one doctor to another... He's medical, though, as opposed to yours, sort of part-time one. To another, due to a constellation of circumstance involving Glastonbury, a moving house, I am alone and can choose any film to see tonight without wifely or child interference.
Go see Teeth.
What should I say?
See Teeth. Yeah, go see Teeth. Can I just say, it was very peculiar sitting here reviewing movies with them actually playing tennis, but there was a moment earlier on when Pat Cash said, somebody dropped a shot, and he said, anybody else in this auditorium could have got that shot. And then he looked at me and he went, even you. And believe me, I'm the one person who could not have got that shot.
I was
shot.
Pointing at you.
I know you were, yeah.
We should say, yes, Mark probably could have got that shot.
Yeah, I probably could have.
Yeah, but what if he doesn't want to see a film which involves, you know...
Well, he should sort himself out. No, Teeth is funny. It's not going to be around for very long. It's a funny film, and you didn't understand the premise of it because you're, you know, not up to speed. But it's funny, and it's nasty, and it's rubbery, and it's subversive. And people should go and see it, because then it would mean that we wouldn't have a box office top 10 in which, you know, fairly unremarkable stuff like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom is right up at the top. Or Sex and the City. Don't go and see Sex and the City. Do anything you want, but don't go and see Sex and the City.
Why?
Because it's absolutely terrible, and it's made a staggering amount of money by being absolutely terrible. And if you carry on making it make money, it will just encourage them to go and make another one. I think they're already doing another one. I mean, I think already the figures add up so that there has to be another Sex and the City movie, which is profoundly depressing.
Hello, Groucho and Harpo. Albeit a few weeks late, I still find myself grasping for air, trying to control myself whenever the subject of Sex and the City is brought up. Since a few years back, I work as an usher at a big cinema in Stockholm.
Oh, yeah.
In Sweden. I have had for a long time back found the TV show to be ghastly, horrible and without merit and was not surprised when my female co-worker convinced me to see it. Apart from the fact that, as with Mark, it bothers me greatly that you can, in 90% of the cases, put an equals to sign between a chick flick and trash, I felt that my cinema had hit a new low. And there's pages of that.
But it is awful. Have you seen it yet?
No.
It is really... there's no need to at all. It is really, really genuinely ghastly. And as I said before, it's not a gender thing. It's just to do with whether you think the movie's any good or not. But I know we have already had an email in from somebody who is qualified clever.
Not just qualified clever, but a doctor from Oxford and lecturing at Cambridge.
That's right.
And like Sex in the City. So we'll continue that. Bright people who have seen Sex in the City
next
week.
Yeah, let's do that. You know, if you're officially clever and you enjoyed Sex in the City, let's make a register.
Movie of the week.
Well, it's a funny old week, isn't it? I mean, Wanted is clearly not the movie of the week because it's all over.
But it's very fun.
Well, it's not. I mean,
it's stupid. Doesn't make sense.
Chronicles of Narnia. Chronicles of Narnia is film of the week. It's that kind of week.
I'm not at all surprised.
No.
Mark, thanks very much indeed. And David, what we should be doing now is just a little bit of assessment of the Federer match with Mark giving a thought just after a rally. What do you think? Would that work?
Absolutely.
Pardon me?
Observe it and describe it.
There's going to be rally driving?
Actually, forget that. It's a really, really, truly horrendous idea. Mark, you can go now.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.